Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in Education podcast, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Chris Adinitz, and I'm talking today with Jeffrey Benson. His book is called Hacking School Discipline Together. Jeffrey's been a teacher of 40 years. He's been a director, a mentor, an author, and a leader of school reform. He's the author of Hanging In, of 10 Steps for Managing Change in Schools, of Teaching the Whole Team, not long ago, of Improve Every Lesson with SEL, which was also a New Books in Education interview back in 2021. It was actually the last time I talked to him. He's written a ton of articles, and he's on the faculty at the Association of Supervision and Curriculum Design. He was also the school director at the first school, or maybe the second school, where I ever taught as a teacher myself way back in the 2000s, a little therapeutic alternative high school in Massachusetts. And so it's a great pleasure to talk with my old friend and my old boss here on the New Books in Education. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Chris. It's just great to be together with you again. Like old times, we're going to sit and talk about education.
Yeah.
Only this time it's going to be recorded for other people to listen to.
That's right. And it's amazing how many things you said, you know, probably in passing that I continue to quote to this day. And I bet you pass them on from your mentors and so on. So it's a delight to continue this chain.
Absolutely. That's the work we do.
All right. So let's talk about hacking school discipline together. It's a discussion framed by 10 hacks. And when I started reading it, I thought it was going to be a lot like your intervention into curriculum design, but it takes us outside the classroom and takes us as into the world of the whole school, which is something I, as a classroom teacher, who've always been a classroom teacher, haven't thought much about. And it was cool to look behind the curtain and see how you, who have been an administrator and played every part, how you see it. So what's the book about?
Yeah, so thanks for that framing, because it's really, it's two or three books in one. Or four or five, as books tend to be. I mean, part of it is, I think all the root of all my work is ultimately any teacher or educator I work with in any fashion. I just want people to remember how important the work they do is and how special and the joy and profundity of our work. And we get lost sometimes because of the day-to-day chores. So that's one part in all my work. So restorative discipline is a very specific thing that I'm very passionate about, but really it's also a entry into school change, which is something that I'm passionate about. Because if you're going to start looking at the discipline system and how adults communicate to each other about kids and how we support each other in doing this work well, you have to start breaking through lines of hierarchy. You have to be talking to each other in ways that we don't normally do. So I love that part of it. And then also it's basically a roadmap, for lack of a better word, of how do you go from where we are now to get to change a school culture. And that's a huge thing to do and not an easy thing to do. And unfortunately, those higher up in school hierarchies tend to do this less than I wish they mm-hmm. did. And so you meet with a lot of resistance when you go to do something significant. So the book's in 10 chapters, and it basically follows like a year in a school, and each chapter covers about a month or 6 weeks in the life of a school. And my favorite part of writing the book was the last part of each chapter, in which I got to write like a novella, that goes through the book. And in the beginning chapter, you meet this group of people in a school who are going to try to bring restorative discipline to the school. And you follow them as characters through the book as they grapple with the difficulty of doing this well. And so I love doing that part of it. You know, we get moved by data and we get moved by theory, but we also get moved by emotion. And I felt it was really important to have a group of people, all of whom are modeled on people I've known, to take us through what it's like to actually try to do the work. And what's it feel like, and how do you do that well? So, yeah.
Yeah, and really, I think your career, or the part of the career where I knew you, has been a tremendous success in that respect. Because when I started working for you, I was very skeptical of all your, you know, restorative practices back 20 years ago, and now it's so normal, and it's something we all do. And you know, it starts with teacher development trainings in August, and then you do a little bit here and there. And we now have, you know, advisory periods, and we have community circles, and we have all these things
Amazing.
That are actively trying to build community and restructure the way we think about things. I think that's changed while I was a teacher, as in this generation, at least. You know, you probably were doing it a generation earlier, but I feel like I've seen it come to, you know, bloom, blossom, come into fruition in my time.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I think, you know, my joke is that I've gotten mainstreamed.
Yeah.
The things I used to do
Yeah.
in these little islands are now actually, well, what we learned from working in alternative schools was there's this great line that what's necessary for some kids is good for all. And it's true about discipline. It's true about differentiating curriculum. It's true about relationships. It's true about opportunities that all kids need to see themselves in the school and to see their particular. I read this great quote that as a school, we should see the value and vulnerabilities of every student. Isn't that great? And I think
Yeah.
that's what we learned in special ed. In
Yeah.
alternative schools, to see the value and vulnerability of every student, and doing it large, did, you know, that's one of the reasons that, when I left the school that I think you left a year or two before I did. It was, all right, I need to see if I can scale up. Like, I know enough now about organizations and schools and kids and teachers and leadership and all that stuff. I'd been blessed to work with amazing people like you, and I had amazing mentors. I was like, all right, I think this is where we have to go. So I've been, you know, I've played my part. I think it's one of thousands of people who said, we can do this with kids everywhere. I'm glad you're somewhere where you see it so much. I do get called to work in places where they don't do this stuff at all. And I'm starting at the very beginning,
Yeah.
which is an interesting challenge. I like that too.
Yeah, well, you're herding cats, and there's going to be some in the front and some in the back and some off in the bushes, and like any other large enterprise.
Right. In
One of
fact,
the, yeah.
I was going to say, in fact, one of the lessons, it's sort of in the book, but it's in a bunch of places, is I always imagine when I'm going in to do school reform, and I do this in various ways. I'm working with the one school here in Massachusetts on changing their elementary school schedule, which is hard to do because it's like a Jenga puzzle. You
Yeah,
can't
that's
move
right.
one piece without. It's really tough. And so I imagine that there are 100 people lined up on the wall who represent the faculty of the school. And the people I tend to work with are the first 15 or so along the wall. They're the early adopters. They're the ones who are kind of excited and they want to get in on this. And I'm someone, they've read my books or articles, they've seen me speak, or it's a topic that they're passionate about already. Then there's about 60 or 70 people who represent the large majority of people in the school who are amenable to change, but need to be convinced for reasons I think are totally okay. I think we do need to sell our product. And then at the very end of the line, there are about 10 people who are not going to get it, who are just not going to change. And I say that with compassion. They should probably not be teaching anymore, but you know, they got their lives to figure out. And I always have to say to the people I'm working with at the front of the line, sometimes I'll say, hey, let's try this next. And I'll see like a veil cross over their face. And I'll say to them, are you looking at those last 10 of the line, at the end of the line again? And they'll nod their heads. I'm like, we can't look at them. The people who need us to do this best are the next 30 people.
Yeah.
They are depending on us to be successful. They want us to be successful. And we can't devote so much of our time, which becomes despairing, to those last 10. And you know, it's similarly, I don't know if you feel this in classes as well, where you can have a class that if I were observing it, would say that was a
Oh,
great
yeah.
class. And there'd be two kids who had struggled and you would just be, yeah, but those two kids, are they, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do with them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
And so,
yeah, go ahead.
no, you do. You go.
I was going to say, like, well, you know, you used to talk about 100 iterations. You have an article
Yeah.
like that, and you used to tell me about, like, just, you know, you don't know if you're introducing this idea of bring in your homework and staple your paper and, you know, sit up straight and go to get, you know, show up ready the first time or the 99th time. And then
Right.
sometimes it'll click and you'll be like, wow, I'm a genius. But like, no, there's actually, this is, I came in on time 99. So
Right. Somebody else
it can
last year got
happen.
the kid from 40 to 70 or 80,
That's
and then you
right.
got to do the last 10 or 15, and you're the like, you know, in fact, at our school, there was a kid who I work with who I love, this great kid. And I was a member of the team, and we probably took her from like number 40 to number 85. And it was because of her. She was an amazing human being. But we as a team did really well. And she went to our buddy Frank's class after mine, and she graduated with him as sort of her lead teacher mentor. And in the yearbook, she wrote to him, "Oh, Frank, I love you so much. You're the greatest person ever. I love you. You saved my life." And to me, she just said, "Thanks, Mr. B." And but Frank came to me and said, "You took her from 40. Thanks for giving me a wonderful 85."
Yeah.
And that's the work we do. We all have our part to play every day. And you know, there's a great line that we have to believe there's a better kid inside every kid who comes to see us. And our job
Right.
is to nurture that. And sometimes we're going to do repetition 35 to 45 that will be lost in history. But if we don't go from 35 to 45, the next teacher has to start at 35 again.
Yeah.
So we've done our work.
Yeah, and I think that's true of all humans, including, you know, those of us who are all grown up and making the same mistakes over and over again as we're. So you do have a you have one of your chapters is called "Leave No Staff Behind." What do you do with these
Yeah.
curmudgeon-y dinosaurs that you cannot convert? What do you do with them?
Well, okay, I'm going to give a few answers because
Yeah.
there's a whole bunch of ways to answer this. There's one way to think of it, like there's a student who's absent from school a lot. Well, first you would say, well, what's causing them to be absent? What's the impediment to them getting into school? And it turns out there's not one thing to do. There are many things. Or someone fails a test, and three kids fail a test in your class. They all need a different reteach. And you have to kind of say, how do we do this? So when I'm in my compassionate view of those people, I'll say, okay, we have to understand them. I think there's a lot of good reason to be resistant to school reform. So I'm going to give you one example. We come in and we say, here's this great new product we have. You can do this. And we give it to you to do. And what we're basically saying is, we're going to bring you to a level of incompetence immediately because you have no mastery in this yet. And you've mastered some aspects of this incredibly wonderful and difficult profession called teaching. And we're basically saying, we're taking your competence away. And who's excited about that? Especially if you're not convinced yet that this is going to be a better product than what you kind of do reasonably well. So the other part, so one of the things is to understand that that's a reasonable resistance. What I talk a lot about in the book and in all my work around this is school reform's a building by building endeavor. Every school has its own cohorts, its own resources, its own demographics, its own heroes, its own myths, its own memes, its own geometry and geography. And you can't just take something that's a significant reform and just say, well, it worked in building A, let's just do the same thing in building B. And I'm also including the administration in being idiosyncratic in every building. And so part of the work is that in building B, if that's your building, we know that we were informed by what worked in building A. So we're building our kind of toolkit of change. But the most important thing for somebody who's skeptical is that one of their peers in the building can say, I did it in this building. This is not theory, but I actually love this product. Sometimes I think it's like everyone's been drinking a sugary little soft drink, and I come along and say, I have a much better product. It's better for your body. It's better for your soul. It tastes great. You'll feel great drinking it. And I got to get people to sip it because they've got this drink that they've drunk for years. And the most important people to do it are peers. So part of the change is getting the next 30 along that line to start sipping it and tasting it and saying, no, I'm going to do this. So it's a 2 to 3 year process, school change, because you work down the line. I think people are also skeptical. There's a notion in organizational change. I think a lot about this, that people are more likely to go along with a reform if they feel there's been a robust process and they've had voice, than if they even like the decision. Even if it's a decision they like, they go, well, how do they know that's going to work? Blah, 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 you know, blah, blah. But if it's like, oh, my peers were part of this plan, I had some input into this, I've seen it work in this school, I think the process was a robust one, I'm more willing to go along. So the peer stuff is really important, which is why, even though I think these reforms can be led by school administrators, what's really important is to have a task force of peers who will practice and try things and do test runs and publicize it and stand up at faculty meetings and say, we're working on this thing. Here's the timetable. We want everyone to try something by the end of this year, but we're not going to ask you to be great at it right away. And we're going to give time to practice it. But we're already like really enthusiastic because, frankly, I have fewer discipline problems in my room. My class empties better. Homework's better. So I want to let you know this is a much better product. So why don't you come and watch me? Why don't you try it and see? So that's kind of the big part of how dealing with those people at the end of the line. And then there are times where I have to say, they're like the accident on the highway. Don't look, drive past. You have to, they're just going to suck you out of your joy. And again, I have compassion for them. But if there are 40, 45, 50 people in the school who want my task force to be successful, we just focus on those people. We're just, let's bring them on. Let's bring them on.
And also, you have this in your earlier chapters too, just about establishing expectations and communicating. This works in the classroom too. If you're going to introduce some rules upon some students, it's nice for them to be able to, first of all, understand where you're coming from and two, say their piece. I think you taught me long ago that you can't fill up a glass of water that's already full.
Oh, wow, that's an old one. Yeah, it's true. And that was also about just people who are emotionally wrought and filled, like they need to get some of that, need some space. They need to chill out. They need to do some calm down stuff, which reminds me, there's a doing discipline in schools is prevention and intervention and invention. And so we think a lot about restorative discipline as intervention. And that's reasonable because even when you get everything in place, there are going to be some kids who are just having bad days. Some kids for whose lives have been so difficult, they're going to misbehave. So we have to, so intervention is always a great thing. And restorative, like I said, restorative discipline is significantly about that. But there's a whole prevention part of it. And there's a chapter in the book devoted to people looking at the school and saying, and we get data. Where are we having the most difficulties with behavior? Why don't we first structurally? I always think school change is 70% structure, 30% skills. I'll give you a really good example. I was consulting at a middle school. I was there very regularly. I wasn't part of the staff, but I was probably there 2 days, 3 days a week. So I knew everyone really well. And I was kind of an all-around coach, consultant. And I used to play basketball with the boys at lunchtime because, I like to play basketball. And the boys were starting to get like in trouble online at lunch, being rambunctious and stuff like that. And the admin came to me and said, you do all that conflict resolution stuff, Jeffrey. Could you work with the boys and help them figure out how to do this better? And I realized that, and in some fashion, I said this to them, conflict resolution skills are really high level social emotional skills. Even those of us who are fairly ex have a lot of expertise still get in conflicts with our spouses. And it takes time to learn how to do it and do it well. And yes, I could work with these boys and maybe they could implement it because the creatures on earth least likely to do conflict resolution are hungry 13-year-old boys waiting to eat and then go out and play. They're like the lowest candidates for being successful. And then you know what? Even if I were successful with them, next year you'd have to hire me to work with the next group of 13-year-olds. So instead, why don't we change how we do lunch?
Yeah.
Let's do this as a structural fix. Let's make it so the boys aren't online as long. So we did a whole other rethink of minimizing the time boys were online and giving them other things to do until it was their turn. And it didn't eliminate, but we tend to think, even for teachers, we tend to think PD before we think structure. And I'm always like, no, structural change first. There's a great line. We shouldn't train people into dysfunction. We should, but sometimes there is. So going back to prevention, prevention is a lot about structural change. You look all over the school and say, where are the snags where kids are getting, having discipline problems in much hallways, bathrooms, lunchroom, recess, getting in and out of the school, lockers, everyone knows it. So what can you do structurally first? And that's a big part.
Yeah, well, one thing you taught me 20 years ago is like you can't give a criticism without giving praise. And it's got to be like, I forgot if you said 3-to-1 or 5-to-1, but
it's supposed
like,
to be 5-to-1, but 3-to-1 makes you better than anybody.
Right.
Still.
So before I say like there's no thesis, this is all one. Why don't you try it in paragraphs? Why don't I say like, hey, what a great idea. Oh, this was a really nice turn of phrase. I thought that was a great example from your personal experience that really connected to the curriculum. And I don't want to burn all of my, you know, those few criticisms I have on something that I could easily avoid with a system. So your hack number 4 is called think structures before skills. And I have these things where I used to always be on their case about being on the phone. And now I got one of these phone charging stations. So they all walk in, they put their phones away, they get extra credit points for plugging their phones in. Right. And then I give them a tech break at the end. So I stop 5 minutes early. They all get their phones. They get to answer their messages without like missing on whatever was happening.
Right.
And I'm no longer wasting all my time like being that nagging voice. Put away your phone, Jeffrey. Put away your phone, Jeffrey.
Right.
Put away your phone, Jeffrey.
It's a structural change.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's meeting an interest. The kids are anxious, you know, and that's the sad part about the modern world. Anxious that they can't go an hour and they might miss something. But if they know before the hour's up, they're going to get a chance to check it.
Yeah.
But I love the idea of making a charging station. So it's not just that they're sacrificing, like amputating part of themselves, but they're actually getting to charge. If I'm going to share that with people,
they
that's
get
going to
extra
make me...
credit. They get their power back, you know, and it by charging station, I just mean it's two power strips taped to a wooden frame with, you know, so this, it's very, it costs, I don't know what it costs, but I think it's like, you could build this for $20, maybe $50.
And worth every penny of it.
And it removes me, you know, because it's, you know, as they say in Godfather 3, it's all, it's not personal, it's business. It's like, I don't want to be the voice, that nagging voice. I've got other things to nag about, and that's not the one I want to waste all my, you know.
It's a great example. And that's what we should do first. You know, one of the things, like with the boys online at lunch or in general, is we shouldn't put people in positions where they have to use their tenuously held skills to be successful. It's not that we don't give them challenges, absolutely, but that those challenges have to be within, like, you know, the zone of proximal development. And behaviorally, we ask too much of kids. It's like just shoving that many people into a halls and the bathroom situation. Like, what do you expect? You know, that's my sort of one of my openings. Kids have misbehaved in schools forever. What do we expect? Why are we surprised? Like, let's like be better prepared. You know,
And then the other thing is, you talk a lot about restorative consequences, where whatever you did wrong, you don't just say like, okay, that's a detention. Like if you throw a piece of paper, I'll say, Jeffrey, please pick up 3 pieces of paper because you threw one. And then you're like, okay, fine, I'm not allowed to do it. And my consequence makes sense for the infraction.
Right. It's the key.
Yeah.
It's like the key mantra of restorative discipline. Yeah. And it, to get this, this is where I think, of course, it's a better product. So I'm going to sell this product a little here.
Yes, please.
It's the mantra is repair the harm done. It's not about the rule that was broken. You have to repair the harm that was done. So you have to be creative sometimes about doing that. Right. So if someone kicks over a trash barrel, they have to clean up the trash. But there's something really important about this versus detention or suspension. I'll talk about detention. I think, let me just talk about detention first.
Yeah.
So kids go to detention. They sit there. They come back to class. They haven't learned any new skills. They haven't had an opportunity to rebuild and repair the harm done. And they're one down still. The part that I love about giving kids the chance to repair the harm and this is a deep one about community, about humans, about teenagers and communities, is that they've earned the right to be forgiven. And I think that's the deepest part of it, that if you don't get a chance to repair the harm, you're not forgiven and your status in the community is one down. Whereas if you get to be able to say, I did the right thing. So part of it is that you, let's say there was something where Chris had to stay and we decided the best time to clean up, come to lunch, have lunch with me, straighten up the bookshelves. I want you to do something equivalent to the harm you did. And we can negotiate what that is. Chris can then say when the kids come back, hey, by the way, I cleaned up the bookshelves. Or I can say, Chris, even the score, we're moving on. And it also means that you and I are not at loggerheads again. Because, you know, once if I've kicked you out of the class, and it's a bad phrase, but I'll use it, and you end up in detention, you come back, everyone's still freaked out that we're going to be at it again. What's changed between Chris and Mr. Benson? But if we can say, hey, Chris repaired the harm, we're all good. It's my favorite. There are many parts of the book that I really, I love putting together. It's when the teacher and the kid who did the harm walk back in the room together and they say, we're all good. And every kid in the class can go, okay, good to know. Because there were witnesses to the harm. So that's a really deep part of, and then you have to be creative. So let's say Chris, you turn out to be a really dysfunctional kid. Chris has a frustrated day. He's out on recess and he's broken a piece of recess equipment. I'm not going to expect him to pay to buy a new one, but he could stay and help clean up after recess for a couple of days, which means he will earn forgiveness. Maybe he'll also get a better relationship with the people who he's working with. Maybe he'll work with the maintenance crew for a day and go around the school and do some fixing up and feel better about himself because he's contributed. And so sometimes you have to find equivalents to that. I do want to circle all the way back to about detentions and suspensions. And going back to those last 10 people on the line, but they're not just the last 10. This is one that a lot of teachers are concerned about. A lot of people who resist restorative discipline are worried about chaos, that kids will get away with things. So I always have to start off with many people saying, I want to let you know that restorative discipline is still discipline and that kids don't get away with stuff, that they have to repair the harm, that's part of it. We'll figure out how they do that. They have to earn their forgiveness back. When someone goes to detention, I actually think that's getting away with it. I want to flip that notion of what does it mean? I do something harmful to the community and the cost to me is going and sitting in a, you know, in school suspension. I actually have not been held accountable. Well, I'm held accountable by repairing the harm. That's what I mean. It's such a better product. The kid gets to earn forgiveness. The kid gets to be reconnected to the school. The kid gets to earn their place back into the community. That's accountability. Sending kids to detention and suspension, not accountability. But I want to say something about that. There are times, and it's in the lists in the book, when we actually do need to temporarily suspend kids. We do need to temporarily have them in detention because it's a community. And sometimes the harm they've done, we need to make a plan. And so it could be that the other kids in the class are freaked out from what Chris did. And we have to have some time for them to know that they'll be okay and that Chris will be okay. Showing up the next day, suddenly back in the room, is not going to make them feel like they've been part of the healing as well, because they've been witnesses or sometimes directly been victims, kind of a strong word, but significantly impacted by Chris's misbehavior in the class or in the hall or whatever. Sometimes we do need to suspend a kid, but I want to come back to only as long as it takes to make the reentry plan. So part of restorative discipline is that there are no set, oh, you do this harm, you have X number of days of anything. It's that you do this harm, we're going to make a plan for you in which you will earn your way back. And for certain kids, that might mean they're back in school the next day because we were able to set up a safety situation and they're going to earn their way back into, you know, the collective community. Some kids, sometimes, you know, it's a couple of days. And yet there's one more part. Sometimes kids need to go to other programs. And I say this with incredible, I just think it's reality and compassion. Part of the history of special ed, there are two parts to it. One part was that kids were excluded and they became, pariahs. They felt that about themselves. The other part is that they were stuck in schools that didn't have the services to take care of them, and they fell apart there. Some public schools, big schools, are not the best place for every kid. And denying them services they need has harmed many kids as well. And so there are times when we have to say we can't do it. And that's out of compassion. We've looked, we've tried. You may remember my first book was called Hanging In, and it was stories of kids. I subsequently wrote an article. It's on my website, jeffreybenson.org, called When Not to Hang In. Because I realized that there was no rubric for saying we've done our best, and now the harm is to the kid being in a system that can't meet his needs every single day. So it's like, have we done this? Have we done this? Have we done this? Have we done this? If we have reluctantly, or maybe sometimes not reluctantly, we say, this isn't the right place for kids. So,
You're talking about 1 in 100, 1 in 20. What percent?
yeah, a small percent of kids
Small percent.
where it's just like, no, we really can't make this work.
Yeah.
And it's okay. It's interesting because special ed laws have a wonderful, they have many special ed laws are like incredibly radical, revolutionary. I mean, if you give this notion that every kid, regardless of their needs or abilities, gets a free public education, is unbelievable. It's sometimes it's we've never funded or resourced schools to be able to do that. And it's okay to say that the kid needs something, but it buried in the laws is you can't say we can't do it because there's not money. It's literally against the regs to say we can't give Chris an outside placement because we don't have the money to do it. It's amazing. So schools will hold on to kids for a real long time because now I'm going to have my admin hat on. It costs a lot of money to send you elsewhere. I have a budget, and that's a lot of money to do. But technically, I'm not supposed to bring that. So there was a, I remember there was a parent at our school, the one that Chris and I were in. This was a high school. And the kid was going into their senior year, and the town, and the kid had done really well in our school. And the town said, we want to bring the kid back. This kid had never been to the public high school. And their parents were arguing, this is our kid's school. They don't know those kids. This is the place they should graduate. These kids should stay here for another year. And the town was kind of pushing back against that. And the parents said, wait, if this school were free, we wouldn't even be having this conversation, would we? And it was like this aha moment. Right. So I always want to come back. This is going back to those last 10 or to all of us. Restorative discipline doesn't mean kids get away with anything. It holds them more accountable than our current system. And there are times when we have to own that we don't have the resources to take care of kids. And that's okay too.
Well, and there's two things in there that I think go to the foundation that, like, the philosophy of what public education is about. One is that we use our public money to take care of the weakest among us, which is not utilitarian at all. It's so, deeply Judeo-Christian in the secular age that it's really hard to name that this is what we are using. And I think people say, like, yeah, but that's not my choice. I was like, that's true, it's not your choice, but that's what this republic is about. And that's how it is. And the second one is there's a lot of kids who come to school who don't have the culture at home to be successful in mainstream America, and we're trying to give that to them, and we're trying to give that to them in a way that they buy in. And so they're like, I really believe that Mr. Benson likes me. And when I mess up, Mr. Benson's gonna not just punish me, but he's gonna show me where I messed up, how I can do better, praise me as I do things right, correct me as I do things wrong. And so then I will know what the heck is going on around me, even if I don't see it in my home, and I'll be able to teach my own children what the heck is going on around me. And so that is so much more valuable than whatever infraction there is.
And there's something in there you said about in deeply in that it's about being in relationship to your teachers that, is the number one factor for resiliency in schools is to feel seen, known, and heard by the adults in the school. It's a super important piece of that. I want to go back to that also teaching kids, you did this, we'll correct it. There's a scene in the book in which we're talking about respect, which is a culturally derived piece, and it's a really tricky waters to navigate when respect in some cultures is looking teachers in the eye, and in other cultures, it's not. When respect in some cultures is speaking up your truth, and respect in other cultures is to just be compliant. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in that. And the teachers of the older kids are saying the kids are so, they speak disrespectfully. They speak, they don't, they're rude. And the kindergarten teacher says, kids in kindergarten are rude too, not just in the upper grades. You should hear the things the kindergarten kids say. And the principal says to the kindergarten teacher, so what do you do when a kid is rude? And the teacher says, oh, I pull them aside and I tell them what they should have said instead of what they said. And we practice for a moment. And then they go back and say the thing they should have said. And everyone in the room was like, oh, why don't we do that with the older kids? And there's some you would change it slightly developmentally for older kids, but it was like that was the most we do that all the time. We say, you broke this, you did this, you said this, you didn't share with Chris your toys. Let's go back and share with Chris. And you do it right away. You know, it's
This comes with
it,
age for me. For me, it comes with age, where I think when I was working for you, there was this fellow, I don't know if you remember him, he was very small, he wasn't growing, and he was very standoffish. And I was like, but how can I let him get away with that? And then you told me the teacher always wins at the end. So like give him some space, give him some space, and then come back and bring him back in, come back and bring him back in. And at that point, I was so young, I think, that I felt like, well, if I give an inch, he's going to take another inch. And if I give him a second inch, then I'll have revolution or whatever I was thinking.
Right, chaos, revolution.
It was a little more parental. If my kids are being disrespectful, I'll say, Jeffrey, you are being so sassy, right? Because I don't want to put you down, but I want to say, like, what you're doing is a little out of place, but we're in a familiar place where, like, I still like you,
Right. Well,
but don't be sassy.
what I've said to kids too in that way, and this is why we have to be role models, and that's part, we're professionals. I'm going to talk a little about that, that we are role models, is I could say to kids, could you stop for a moment? I've never spoken to you that way. I just want you to realize I've never spoken to you that way. So could you please not speak to me that way? And I had to have earned that moment to say that because that's important. That's when so many kids through the years, I could just see they would like, whoop, oh, right. Well, Mr. B wasn't one of those adults who did that. It's a tough job. I was talking to some teachers the other day about this, that there are certain kids. So part of doing our work too is to acknowledge that there are kids we don't love, that they're hard for us to like. And you may love a kid who I struggle with, and I may love a kid who you struggle with. And when that difficult kid for me is absent, my class runs better. There are certain, it does. We just
That's
know that there
true.
are kids.
That's true.
It's totally true. And I'm happy that he's absent. I'm saying it's a he. I'm happy they're absent.
We
The
still
next
love
day when
them.
they
We're just happy that.
show up at the door, I say to them, oh, I really missed you yesterday. I'm glad you're back. I am lying, but I am a professional, and that kid deserves me to say that. And that's part of being a professional. And I think a lot about us as being professionals, that as teachers, my dentist has her diploma on the wall. My doctor has his diploma. My car mechanic has certifications from all the places he's learned to do stuff. We don't put our diplomas up as teachers. Isn't that strange? Why don't we do that? We should definitely do it. I know a few schools who've taken this on, especially for middle and high school, the conversations then you can have natural conversations about going to college are wonderful. And I could say, as I had said once, the kids looked at mine and said, oh, Mr. B, you went to a state college. Yeah, I can talk to you about that. I have to tell you, Chris went to Harvard. I make just as much money as he did. And we would joke about it, but we're professionals. And so even circling back to restorative discipline, we're professionals in a learning institution, and kids need, and it is not the math curriculum or the science curriculum or any of those other curriculum, but I want to suggest to everyone who's listening that you all have done restorative discipline in some fashion in your work. You have all had times with kids who you said, I can work this with this kid. I can help this kid do better. we all know how to do that. Well, some kids we don't know how to do it with. And that's why we need to do it as a team. And we need to build up a body of practice. So there's part in the book about where I start this work, in almost all schools is where I start in the first chapter, is that when a kid is misbehaving in my classroom and the class is starting to get out of hand, we're losing the momentum, I can't circle back and get the kid hooked back in, it probably should leave the room. But if I'm the teacher, do I believe that I will be supported to send the kid out? Because there's no line that's okay. Yes, it's okay to send kids out. So I hear from principals a lot, I don't know why they sent this kid to the office. They should have taken care of this in the classroom. And I hear from teachers, I don't know when I'm supposed to send a kid to the office. And one version, as a teacher said to me, is I'm worried that it would show up on my evaluation that I send kids to the office when I shouldn't have. But I would never expect it to be on my evaluation that Jeffrey sent kids to the office when he should have. So the first place is, let's decide what are the administrative things to handle and empower the administration to use all of their tools to do restorative discipline with this kid. And then let's say what belongs to the teachers and how do we support you? So part of the training over time is after we make that definition of what that line is, we give everyone toolkits. So the administration has a toolkit for when kids show up in their office, how do I restore things with this kid? I have this list of 15 things I can do. Teachers have a similar list. I'm holding on to this kid. I don't have to send them to the office for detention or suspension. I'm going to do one of these restorative practices. And I learn how to do that. And I build the relationship with the kid. And if it fails, then I send them to the office.
Yeah.
We always have that outlet. We can always do that.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point because I've never thought of a school that way. For me, the school ends at my classroom door. I think I've sent a kid out once in 5 years, you know. But I do have other tricks where I say, here's a manila folder. Please take this to the office, right?
Right.
And it's just like, go take a walk.
Yeah.
When you know, go take a walk, you're not in trouble. But maybe when whatever you were bothered about will vanish as you go for a 5 minute walk and come back.
Right.
There's little tricks like that.
Right. And let me ask you, when you do that to a kid, do they know what you're doing? Like you're giving them an out?
No, it's like, this is very important. I need you to take this to Principal Benson.
And I happen to be picking the kid in the class who's most disruptive right now to
yeah.
do that.
You don't think, I don't know that they're that reflective. You know, I don't
Interesting.
Know. I could be wrong.
Funny.
I could be wrong. But you so also have this emphasis on like a school culture, which as a classroom teacher, I never think about. You used to say when I was working for you that, we can do anything, but we can't do everything.
Right.
And you repeat that in this book, you know, the school has infinite needs, but finite resources.
Right.
So look, if you're sitting as a principal, what would be your priorities? How would you get all these very different teachers, very different ages and mentalities and thoughts and schools of teaching and approaches and attitude toward the population that you're teaching?
Right.
What are the things that you would choose to focus on?
So that's a really good question. My own practice first. So I would continue to have kids sent to the office for discipline until we set that up. And then I would say, here are the restorative tools I will use when kids are sent to the office. And I will talk to you about the outcomes. And I will help you understand the choices I made so that it isn't just that a kid will show back up in your room. And so this is one of the teachers' fears is, oh, the kid went to the office. And they think, what happened?
Yeah,
they got slapped on the hand and a chocolate bar. Or worse, the kid ranted about me. And now the principal has this thought about me as a teacher, blah, blah. So there's first that the principal, the people in the discipline office have a rich toolkit of we can do all of these things. And the second thing is that you have to communicate back to the teacher in the classroom, here's what we did. And here's your role. So for instance, if you send a kid to the office and I do a restorative piece and I come back. So we have this part about, I bring the kid back to the room. Do you want to talk to the kid, Chris, in the hallway for a couple of minutes while I cover the class and make sure he'll tell you what we did in the office and there's a piece for you to play? Or do you need to talk to the kid because you still want to settle something with the kid? I'll cover the class. Or you might say, I'm fine. I just needed the kid. You calm the kid down. That's great. I'll talk to the kid later. It's not something we need to do now. So those first one is really We start modeling restorative practices. We communicate to the staff what we're doing, and we let the staff know if they have a role in the ongoing practice with this kid. So it may be that Chris, what I talked to this kid about was that the kid would like to have a little time to talk to you at lunch one day this week about what he's struggling with. Great.
Yeah.
You know, or maybe the kid will come back and say, I can't sit next to this other kid. This kid drives me crazy. And what do you, can we do a little seating plan differently? I have the time in the office to work this stuff out.
Yeah.
But I would never impose it on you. See, that's the part. I have to say, with, how do I partner with you? I've come up with these ideas with the kid. You know, can you implement them? What will work?
Yeah. No, that's a really good point, because it's often, I feel like somebody has impinged on my little kingdom. And I think that's the same relationship teachers have with students. You know, I would do what you asked me to do, Mr. Benson, but I wish you didn't ask me publicly. Or,
oh,
you know, like, I wish you could just ask me quietly on the side. And you don't know how I feel because blah, blah, blah. And like, I never thought. And then it's really nice for the teacher to say, like, yeah, I didn't think about that. I'm sorry. Because how often do teachers apologize to kids? Not often.
Not a lot. Or principals to teachers,
yeah,
even. You know, I the apologizing is one of the great restorative practices. I was consulting to a school in which kids, when they were sent to the detention room, had to write an apology. And unfortunately, they became pretty perfunctory. And I was at the, I was in the school, and I was hanging around the detention room, and this kid who I knew pretty well kind of came storming in from a classroom, and he was, teacher. And so I was like, you know, just tell me, well, what happened? What happened? And I was like, okay, well, you have to write an apology, you know, I will. Got to figure out what you're going to apologize. I apologize. I didn't do anything. And then the kid says, oh, give me the paper. I'm just going to write something. I was like, no, actually, no. You're not going to do that. You can stay in here all day, but that's not really an apology. And then I worked this out, and this became part of my practice. And I said to him, in that whole story you told, in which everyone did everything wrong and you did nothing wrong, I'm going to bet there was one moment that you could have done something better. Not that you are like the one who caused everything, Chris, but in that whole story you told me, is there anything that you think I should have done? I could have done this better. I could have this one. Is there one part of this that you wish you had done differently? And this kid said to me, yeah, I shouldn't have probably yelled at the teacher. And I said, okay, that's what you're going to apologize for. And that's because a good apology says that I myself have let myself down. I have gone below my own standard. And so the kid wrote, I'm really sorry, I shouldn't have yelled at you. I was like, now you can go back to class because you own something that you really believe you could have done better. And that's the heart of a good apology. So as a principal, I could say, Chris, I'm really sorry at staff meeting that I didn't give you enough time to answer that question. Because I value, I hold the standard that we give staff time to talk, and I interrupted you.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I don't want to do that again. That's my bad. Or as a teacher, I could say, Chris, I'm sorry I didn't give you think time. You know, I cold called on you. I never like cold calling on kids. And sorry about that. I'll try not to do that again, because that's where I, and you know what I came to love about this as a teacher and as a principal was that I got to reinforce the values of the school. Like I say, because the standard we hold is that we give think time, because the standard we hold is that we don't interrupt each other, because the standard we hold is that we make sure everyone has enough pencils to run a classroom. And I get to keep repeating the mission, the value of the schools in that. And that's a really good thing. I remember I was teaching this to a group of people who are going to become principals. And this guy said to me, so do you think I should make mistakes on purpose so that I can reinforce the school value? I said, don't worry, buddy.
You're one of these humans.
Right. You're one of us. And just find what was that. So that's one of the things about restorative discipline that's also an important part of healing the harm, is that the kid has to not just perfunctorily do anything, which is why now we don't hold kids accountable and we just send them to detention or suspension. It really takes a little adult support for the kid to identify something they wish they had done better.
Yeah.
And then subsequently to make a plan for what's when you're in that next part. So there's a prevention part in the book that is a really important part of practice. There's a lot of schools, which is that every kid has like a chill out practice. That I have two or three things that if I am starting to escalate, I can do to get out of that. And it's, we have a menu of stuff, and each of us pick different things. Like I might pick reading. You might not pick reading, sitting quietly. I might pick going to the office to deliver a manila envelope.
Yes.
Somebody else might not, because I wouldn't trust the kid to go to the office when they're in that condition. Somebody might be, oh, can I go and just straighten the bookshelves? Somebody else might say, I want to just stare out the window. But that everyone has a plan. So you learn, this is the invention part. There's prevention, intervention, and then invention. What did we learn from that time when you couldn't get out of that situation? What tool could have worked in that situation? And we want every kid to have two or three things that they can do to not repeat the behavior. Because it's usually an escalating thing, And I love it when kids say, I want to go to talk to a counselor. God, I love when they say that one, because it means they're connected. It means they have a relationship with a counselor. It means that they're understanding their own inner turmoil that's growing. And that's another gift kids get from when we do restorative discipline, is a sense of themselves. There's a great line, it's a quote from somebody in the book. Punishment is what someone does to you. Discipline is what someone does for you.
Well,
And
and
this,
also, like, we it just also shows you care a lot, right? We discipline our children because we want them to be successful human beings. We're not going to go tell some other kid at the playground, hey, do this, because that's not my responsibility. And you in my classroom, you're my responsibility. I'm deeply invested in your success going forward for the good of the nation.
Oh, yeah. One of my mentors used to say to me when I left his office, and this may have been back just a little before you came to the school, I would leave his office and he'd say to me, okay, Jeffrey, go out there and save democracy for another generation.
Yes.
I say, thanks, Bob. But I actually believe that that's what we do in schools, that almost every person on the street would fail every high school final.
That's right.
So I think what the exercise we do for those 12 years of public education, or 13 years or whatever, is to say that you need to function in a community. And we are going to take you, put you in these communities of kids who are like you and not like you. And we're going to say, we're going to make this work. This is an audacious, outrageous challenge to us, that schools are really the place where we learn. Everyone's going to leave school and be in some sort of community, whether it's a job or a family, a sports team, at their YMCA, they're going to be on the streets with people. And that's the enduring lesson of school, is really how to be a member of a community with then cognitive skills that you can bring to make that community a better place. And restorative discipline is sort of comes back to that, is that where's your place in this community, and how do you build it? How do you restore it? How do you find it? Because yeah, we're not doing this public education thing just because we have nothing better to do. It's like we want them to carry on democracy for another generation. Let's make sure we do that.
Amen. Amen. Well, I think that is the perfect place to stop. This bell is going to ring in 2.5 minutes. So,
I figured I was giving the end part there, Chris.
so dear listeners, go to jeffreybenson.org to find a bunch of resources. This book is called Hacking School Discipline Together. And I also recommend Improve Every Lesson with SEL, which came out in 2021. And I'll put the link in the notes below so you can hear me and Jeffrey talk about that one a couple years ago. And I can't
And
wait to the.
maybe we'll have told the same stories back then. I don't remember.
We always do. I can't wait till the next one, Jeffrey. Thanks so much.
It's an incentive for me to write another one so I can talk to you.
And
Take care,
excellent.
Chris.
Until then.
All right, bye-bye.